for me, for that's how it would seem to my pious countrymen. And yet, that wasn't the worst of it. As I learned when we'd led our screws through the rubble-strewn streets and past the shattered walls of what had once been shops and churches and stone houses, and came to the broad plaza before the burned-out shell of the huge palace, once the largest building, they say, between Egypt and the Cape, where long-dead kings of Abyssinia had kept their courts amidst the wealth and splendour of a continent. If Prester John existed, this was where he'd sat his throne, where the scorpions and lizards now scuttled among the broken masonry. Once it must have been the wonder of Africa, a great city of fabulous wealth and 10,000 inhabitants. Now it reminded me of those age-old ruins of North Africa and Middle Asia, and I must have asked aloud for the 20th time, what in God's name had possessed Theodore to destroy such grandeur?
"Because he hated it," says Ulibar contemptuously, "not only for its comfort given to rebels, but for its splendour and treasure and traditions which seem to mock his stolen royalty. Gondar the Great, the glory of Habesh, a noble city of nobles, was a living reproach to the purge seller's brat."
It came on to rain at sunset, one of those crashing tropical downpours with sheet lightning crackling on the western horizon and thunder booming overhead. So we bivouacked in the porch of one of the four churches, which were the only buildings Theodore had left standing. It was dry and snug, with the outer door pulled to, cutting us off from the city's desolation. And when I'd lit a fire with one of my Vesuvians, Ulibar, such a worldly wise and cultivated little savage in so many ways, had cried out in alarm the first time I'd used one. She set to work preparing a stew of game and kid. I led our beasts through the arch into the empty nave, where I spread their fodder and rubbed them down, and took a quick deco around in the last of the light from the high, unglazed windows. Theodore might have spared the building, but he'd stripped it bare. There was nothing but a broken font and a bare altar, behind which was another of those crazy frescoes which I've already told you of. This one depicted the children of Israel crossing the Red Sea, pursued by Pharaoh's army, who were holding their muskets over their heads, presumably to keep their ancient Egyptian powder dry. For the rest, there was nothing but a heavy trapdoor in the wooden floor, which covered the area before the altar. Elsewhere, the floor was bare earth to the walls, in one of which there was a closed side door. I heaved up the trap, whose slats were warped and shrunk with age, and there beneath was a small cellar, about 12 feet by 12 and 8 deep, empty but for a few ancient pots, and no doubt interesting assorted insect life. I replaced the trap and joined Ulibar in the porch, where we ate our supper by the shadowy firelight, with the storm bellowing outside. And now she told me the full, unspeakable tale of what Theodore had done to the old city in the autumn of 66.
He had wrested tribute from it in the past, so the people expected no more than another shearing of their golden fleece, and came out to greet their emperor, protesting loyalty and hoping to win his favour. They might as well have tried to charm a crocodile. Although the rebels had fled away at his approach, their recent presence was all the excuse Theodore needed to loot the city to its final ruin. The wealth of Selesi, the gold of Kuxuam, the silver of Bata, the gems from the mines of Solomon beyond the mountains of the moon, the silks and paintings, and even the precious manuscripts were all plundered to the uttermost scrap and coin. Never was such a pillaging. Aye, they lived richly in the Gondar that was.
She poured us cups of Tej and sat back against the wall, golden in the firelight, sipping her cup and telling her dreadful tale as lightly as a fairy story.
But to strip the city to its ruins was not enough. Gondar itself must cease to be. His citizens, all 10,000, were herded out like cattle, and the whole town given to the flames. The palace, the treasury, the 40 churches, the fine homes of the rich and the hovels of the poor. Gondar burned from end to end, and the glow was seen in the sky from Lake Ashangi to the frontiers of Tigray and Sudan. And when the priests cried out, calling down curses on his head, he had them bound, hundreds of aged men and thrown into the fire so that they burned alive to the last man. But did that satisfy him, do you think?
She leaned forward to pick up the Tej flask, the black arm and eyes watching to see the effect of her story, even smiling a little in anticipation.
Let me fill your cup, you who love fair women, so that you can steady your spirit while you hear the rest. For now, Theodore remembered that when the folk had come out to greet him, they had been led by the girls of the city, dancing and singing.
Their song was the signal for the rebels to flee, cries he. Traitresses, bring them to me.
And they too, every girl, from child to young woman, were thrown alive into the flames.
She paused to sip her drink.
The rest of the people he crucified or cut to pieces. What do you think of that, Effendi?
It is true, you know. Every soul in a great city exterminated by the fire, the cross, and the sword, thousand upon thousand, all Habesh knows it. What will your general say?
Breathe a sigh of relief, most likely, since it will solve a problem that's bound to be exercising him. What to do with Theodore, I mean. This makes it simple. The bastard'll have to go.
You will try him in a court and put him to death.
Oh, I doubt that. What would we charge him with? We've nothing against him but kidnapping a few of our people, mistreating them and so forth. Can't hang him for that. What he does in his own country to his own folk ain't our indaba. Can't quote you the law, but I'm pretty clear that's how it stands. Why, I can think of two campaigns that I've been in India and China, where ghastly things were done by native rulers. Women, in fact. Dreadful bitches. But we didn't lay a finger on them.
But you said of Theodore, he will have to go.
So he will, one way or t'other. Bullet in the back of the head, shot trying to escape. Dead of a surfeit of lampreys, who knows? I gave her a précis of my Harper's Ferry adventure, where, for reasons of state, I was supposed to shoot mad John Brown, so that the Yankee authorities wouldn't have the embarrassment of trying and topping the daft old bugger, which I didn't, as you probably know. But that was a different case. Theodore'll have to die, somehow. Can't execute him, but can't have him hanging around all shot on a pension, either. Public wouldn't stand it. He'll just have to be done in on the quiet. Accidental-looking.
What hypocrites you are.
No such thing. It's just the civilized way of doing it, that's all. What would you do with him, then? She leaned back against the wall in a way which stretched her tunic most distractingly, put her hands behind her head, and gazed pensively up at the flickering fire shadows on the opposite wall.
Give unto me. He would take a year to die. Perhaps two.
First of all, I would have the bones of his hands and feet removed, one at a time. Then the larger bones of his arms and legs. This would be done by our most skillful surgeons, who would sew up the wounds, taking care to keep him alive and conscious. She sighed contentedly, settling down to put her imagination to work.
Next.
But I shan't tell you what she said next, because, like me, you may just have had dinner. I'll say only that I hadn't heard the like since my fourth wife, Sonsi Array, described what she'd done to captured scalp hunters in the winter of 49. You'd not give him the option of a fine, then, says I. Just so. Well, my dear, I hope you get the chance, because the evil swine deserves it. But I don't suppose you will, what?
If I am queen of Gala, who knows? Says she softly. If your general wishes to avoid the responsibility of punishing Theodore, might he not leave the task to the ally who had helped him to take Magdala?
Fortunately, I'm an old hand at keeping my countenance when mines are sprung under me, so I took a long pull at my Tej and thought in haste, for this was her whole card, faced with a vengeance, and I must take care. That ally, as I understand it, is Queen Mastiat, says I. She's the one I've been ordered to approach, leastways. Ulaba sat upright, very erect in the firelight, and pushed her hands beneath her braids, raising them from her head, letting them fall and raising them again, then turning her head to regard me steadily from those slanting black eyes, the heavy lips parting as she took a deep breath. It was calculated and most striking, a gesture that said, "Look at me, voluptuous romp that I am, female tigress and woman of destiny, for I'm turning my batteries on you, and by gad, you'd best make your mind up." She posed for a long moment to make sure I noticed, no doubt, and then said,
"If Mastiat were no longer Queen of the Wallace,
then I suppose I'd have to approach Schwarketi of the Ambos, wouldn't I?"
"Bah!"
She spat it out in contempt, swirling her braids.
"To what end? Who would follow that dread of Kron against Magdala? You think, because she presumes to dethrone of all Gala, that she can command loyalty even from her own tribe? She is nothing, a name only. She is no rival to Mastiat."
"Is anyone?" says I. And she fluffed out her braids again, tossing her handsome head, and then burst out laughing.
"So we come to it. Yes, there is one. And you know her."
She leaned towards me, proud and confident.
"The Basha Falaka Speedy will have told you all about the third pretender, the concubine's bastard who has twice rebelled. You did not know? And for her treason, was sent from the court of her royal ancestors and forced to marry a commoner, a mere petty chief, a chief so feeble that Gobazi holds him captive. So who is she to challenge Mastiat, her sister? Mastiat, who is strong and crafty and has held her throne against Wakiti and such warlords as Gobazi and Menelek these 2 years. Mastiat, who commands 10,000 swords, oh aye," she added, sniffing, "and has a way with men. Soft-fleshed and indolent as she is." "Well, she is not alone in her way with men, is she?"
And she gave her braids another lift and flaunt. No, she was not. But the diplomatic problem facing me was a nice one. In effect, I was being asked if Queen Mastiat was somehow, and God alone knew how, replaced by Queen Ulaba, would I, as Britannia's envoy, recognize and do business with her? That plainly would depend on whether she could fill Mastiat's shoes, which at the moment, given her situation, seemed unlikely. Then again, she was plainly intent on a coup d'etat, so she must have reason to believe she could pull it off, no doubt by kicking Mastiat's bucket for her. Ergo, she must be counting on mighty support from within the Wallogala community, and since, as she'd remarked, she did have a way of enlisting masculine sympathy, no doubt that support would be forthcoming. Sufficient to do the trick? That I couldn't tell. But the immediate question was, if she did succeed in mounting a palace revolution, what help, if any, would she expect from old Flashy? You see my dilemma. She was my only hope of reaching Queen Mastiat, and must not be antagonized. And, however unlikely it seemed, if by some freak of chance and design she managed to supplant Mastiat in the next 2 weeks, she would be the key to Gala support against Theodore. But if she tried a coup and it failed, I daren't be any part of it. Not only would Napier be left without a Gala to bless himself with, my essentials would be used to decorate somebody's spear. The whole thing was wild and imponderable, and downright impossible to predict or plan for. So all I could do for the moment was keep this mad hoyden sweet and see how the sparks fell. All this in a matter of seconds, while she watched me as though I were an opposing duelist, the firelight glinting in her eyes, intent on mine, lips parted and expectant. And since there's only one absolutely safe response to that hopeful feminine regard, I gave her my sentimental, gentle leer, took her shoulders tenderly in my hands, brought my lips towards hers, and stopped dead, the hairs bristling up on my neck. The storm had blown itself out, and the only sounds about us were the soft crackle of the dying fire, the stirring of our horses in the nave, the faint splash and trickle of water across the ground outside the porch door. And now, of a sudden, not far distant, the clatter of a stone disturbed somewhere out in the darkness, the ring of shod hooves, and a voice raised in a harsh shout. If there was a man in those days who could move faster in a crisis than H.P. Flashman, I never met him. But there was a woman who could have given me a head start. Ulubu Walk of Tigre, the nearest thing I ever saw to chain lightning with a link snapped. Before I'd even taken in the meaning of that noise without, she was past me like a whippet, kicking the water chatty onto the fire as she sped to the door. A second later, I was beside her, peering through a crack in the ramshackle timbers. And there, at the other end of the plaza, a bare 50 yards off, torches were flaring in the dark, and shadowy figures of men and horses were moving through the ruins. Had they caught a glimpse of our fire through the rickety timbers? It seemed not. Uluba's quick action had doused it in a hissing cloud of steam, and there was no cry of alarm from the torchbearers, whoever they might be. A question I put to her in a hysterical squeak as we crouched in the darkness.
"Brigands," she gasped. "Sudanis, surely. No troops of Habesh or honest travellers would be abroad in this weather at night. Least of all in Gondar the Accursed."
She didn't need to add that discovery would mean rape and enslavement for her, and unspeakable death for me. That's what she'd expected from her own Gala kinsfolk, and Sudanis were notoriously monsters of cruelty. My instinct was that we should bolt from the side door with a couple of horses, but she cut off my breathless suggestion by retorting that they would run us down in no time, and if we lay low, the odds were they'd pass us by. "Ignoring the only decent shelter in this bloody town," says I. But before she could reply, there was a sudden shout from the darkness, followed by a commotion in Arabic which I couldn't make out, and then Ulubu's fierce whisper in my ear, "They've smelt our fire." And as if that wasn't enough, one of the bandit's horses decided to neigh its confounded head off, which brought an answering high-pitched whinny from the nave behind us. All things considered, I think Ulubu and I showed uncommon presence of mind. Through the crack in the door we could see the bandit gang starting towards us in full cry, but before they'd gone a yard I had her by the wrist and was making tracks for the nave. Flight from the church on foot was out of the question. There wasn't time to mount up before they'd be on us, but there was that heaven-sent cellar in front of the altar, and with the nave barely lit by the moonshine through the high windows they'd never see the trap. I had it flung back in a twinkling, but to my consternation Ulubu pulled free from my grasp and raced to the side door, thrusting it open before running back to me. Clever lass, the bandits would see it and think we'd gone that way. I'd used the same dodge myself when pursued by peelers at home. I swung her down into the cellar, she dropped like an acrobat, and a second later I was slipping over the edge, closing the trap above me as I jumped the last few feet to the cellar floor. We heard the church door crash open and pounding feet, but they wasted no time in exclamation, and the first words I heard were a sharp command in Arabic, directing pursuit through the side door. They were in the nave, taking quick stock like the professional chaps they were, and presently their voices filtered down to us through the ill-fitting trap, while we clung together instinctively in the dank little cellar, like children at hide-and-seek.
"Three of them, Sadat?"
"Nay. One of those beasts is a pack animal, and only two have eaten and drunk by the dead fire, one of them a woman."
"How can you tell?"
"Use your nose, fool. Musk oil."
"Ha! She should be young, then."
Coarse laughter.
"Hey, Yusuf, look well out yonder. She can't have gone far."
Suddenly light was shining down through the cracks in the trap. They'd brought their torches into the nave, and must have fixed them, for the light shone steady. Oh, God. Would they see the trap? We huddled as far back as we could go to the side of the cellar, in the hope that if the trap were opened, we'd be out of eyeshot of anyone looking down. Unless they dropped in, so to speak. Quite so. We could only wait, Ulubu's cheek running sweat against mine, while heavy feet thumped the wooden flooring just above our heads, and Sadat, the musk oil expert, was saying that this place would do as well as any other. So let Yakub and Gamal bring the stuff inside, and have a care how they handled it, careless dogs that they were. Now there was great bustle, with more of the gang arriving, sounds of heaving and exertion and commands, a ponderous weight dropped on the floorboards, and through all the clamour, a voice gentling our horses, which had been alarmed by the uproar, while another was roaring to Yusuf for news of the fugitives, supposedly being pursued through the night. Someone close above us was demanding what should be done with the stuff, and my blood froze at the reply.
There must be a cellar under the trap yonder. What better place for the goods?
Ulaba couldn't repress a gasping sob. Then,
why has God ordained that I should ride with fools? Wondered Sadat. What worse place could there be than one where folk are sure to look? Eh? Oh, aye. Well, then where shall we put it? Underground, camel spawn. Yonder, by the wall. You dig a hole and bury it, and cover all with rubble, so that only one lynx-eyed and enlightened by God, like Mahmud here, could hope to find it.
Did he call me lynx-eyed and enlightened by God?
Aye, but he didn't mean it. Get a spade, clown. Why must I be the one to dig? Oh, lend a hand, then.
Ulaba was limp against me, gasping with relief, and I was shuddering weakly as I heard them hauling some heavy article across the trap. And then came the crunch and scrape and foul language of labourers delving in the packed earth. Above that, we heard our horses being appraised and their burdens examined. Men coming and going, a disgruntled Yusef reporting that whoever the bastards were who had fled into the night, they were nowhere to be found. Demands for rest and food, to which Sadat, who was evidently their captain, retorted that they were riding out as soon as the goods had been safely concealed. And other conversation of the kind you'd expect to hear from marauders discussing the affairs of the day. I wish now that I'd paid closer attention, for there was interesting stuff about the possibility of enlisting gang members as guards for the Metemma caravan, or taking a slap at one of the supply depots being established by the godless Ferengi invaders. But I was in too fine a funk to concern myself with anything but keeping tight hold of Ulaba, as two interminable hours crawled past, and my heart stopped whenever a footstep came near the trap.
"Please, dear God," I kept muttering, "don't let any of them get curious about the cellar."
And I was just beginning to believe they'd do their business and leave us undisturbed when,
"Aye, that's deep enough. Lift it over. Will it be safe? When do we return for it?"
"When we've scouted this Ferengi army and seen what's to be had from them.
Perhaps from Theodore, too. He carries his treasury with him, like enough." "What? Despoil Theodore, go rob a lioness of her cubs?"
"Aye. We do better to carry our treasury safe to Kassala instead of burying it in this grave of serpents." "I had to leave it here. God knows it cost enough in blood and sweat to get it."
"Eh, Sadat, let's have another look before we cover it. Just a look!"
Cries of agreement, and Sadat, the indulgent ass, let them go ahead. There was a crash as of a lid being thrown back, delighted gloating, a warning snarl to Mahmud to take care, and then an almighty clatter of coin being dropped, ringing and rolling across the boards, and, dear Jesus, dropping through the cracks in the trap to the floor of the cellar. Ulaba sobbed, my innards did a cartwheel, and recrimination raged overhead. Mahmud being cursed for an idiot, coins being scraped up, some mean son of a bitch crying that a few had fallen through the trap, Sadat shouting to let him alone and get the chest closed and interred, and the mean bastard crying that he was shot if he'd lose them, and throwing back the trapdoor. Torch glare suddenly lit up the centre of the cellar, but we were in deep shadow against the side wall, and all that we could see through the open trap was two pairs of boots and robed legs up to the thigh. We must be out of their owner's line of vision. But if they stooped to look under the floor, would they see us in the gloom? If they descended...
"There they are! By Shaitan, Sadat! If you don't want them, I do!"
There must have been a dozen or more dollars glinting on the stony rubble of the floor, and as a booted leg swung over the edge of the trap, I caught the glint of steel in Ulaba's hand in the shadows, and my hand was on the butt of my Jostin, for all the good that would do. The second boot swung down.
"Wait, you fool!" roars Sadat, laughing. "Look before you leap, man!"
There was a sudden howl of alarm from the man about to jump. The booted leg shot upwards as he fairly threw himself out of the trap, his mates crowing with mirth, and I stood paralyzed between relief and revulsion. It is the practice of the female scorpion, after giving birth, to carry her young on her back, and even with six of the loathsome little transparent monsters in residence, there was still no lack of room on the scaly top of the enormous yellow horror scuttling among the fallen coins. She must have been 6 disgusting inches long, not counting the great sting curved up and over her ghastly brood, and she wasn't alone in her nest, neither. Papa and a couple of uncles were on hand, and a joyous sight they all were, bless their horny little hides, for they'd saved us from detection and death, no error. Not that they'd have done our intruder any harm through his stout half-boots, but they were a grand discouragement to coin-collecting. The trap was slammed shut to a chorus of jeers and taunts, and we were left in darkness and, in my case, imminent danger of heart failure. I was drenched in sweat, and Ulliver was shaking as though with an ague. The danger might have passed, but it hadn't gone. The force with which the trap had been closed had broken one of its slats, and through the gap I had a view beside which Mama Scorpion would have looked quite charming. The head and shoulders of a Sudani brigand listening to the orders which Sadat was giving for their departure. The odds are you'll never meet one of the Sudani criminal classes, so I'll tell you that this representative looked like an indescribably evil cathedral gargoyle, hook-nosed and vulpine, with a tuft of beard, a steel cap with chainmail ear guards over black hair falling to his shoulders, and a grinning mouthful of jagged yellow tusks. Happy the bride who wakes up to see that on the pillow, thinks I, and was damn glad when he moved out of sight. Presently they left the nave, and we heard them mounting up, but by mutual consent, and not a word said, we stayed put until dawn, by which time we reckoned they'd be well away. It was not comfortable, for with those fine specimens of Boothus arachnidae rustling about on the floor, we don't sit or lie down, and while, like the Sudani, we were well shod against their stings, I found myself wondering if the horrid little buggers could climb or jump. My legs were painfully cramped by the time daylight began to filter through the broken trap, but after chafing some life into them and satisfying myself that all seemed quiet, chez Scorpio, I took three hasty strides, hurled back the trap, and swung myself out. Ulliver quickly followed, and there we were, chilled to the bone, at dawn, in an empty church in a ghost city, and not a thing to bless ourselves with except the clobber we stood in, my jostling and cartridge belt, and Ulliver's knife. Our horses were gone, with the saddlebags containing all our food, gear, spare kit, and dollars. And we were a day's march from Lake Tana, and heaven knew how far from Queen Mastiat's camp. "Well, at least we can put our finances in order," says I. "Like old Ali Baba, we've lain doggo while the 40 thieves cacheted their loot. Now all we have to do is find it and fill our pockets." She hadn't heard the old tale, so I told it to her while we fossicked about. She was much taken with Morgiana's boiling the robbers in oil, I remember. The cachet was easy to find under a layer of rubble by the wall of the nave, and at the cost of skinned fingers and broken nails, we clawed up the loose earth to reveal a stout iron-shod chest. It wasn't locked, and when I heaved up the lid, we were looking at a sizable fortune in Maria Theresa's. Jewelry, wrought precious metal, gold pieces of a currency unknown to me, and carved ivory. We filled my pockets and her wallets with the gourchis, $100 apiece or thereabouts, and reluctantly abandoned the rest, except for a fine ebony-hafted Damascus scimitar, which I took, and various jewelled bangles, necklaces, and a gold fillet and veil, which Ulliver fell on with cries of delight. She was a very feminine Amazon, really, preening herself in a polished silver hand-mirror, and gloating as she threw it and other choice pieces into the cellar, so that the Sudanese would have to brave the scorpions to retrieve them, and lamenting that we couldn't capture the female and her young and enclose them in the chest before we reburied it, thus ensuring a jolly surprise for the returning robbers. Quite splendid in her malice she was. I'd not have been surprised if her braids had stood on end and hissed at me. Being famished, and not knowing how soon the Sudanese might come back, we made speedy tracks out of Gondar. From a vantage point on the south wall of the ruined palace, we could survey the country as far as Lake Tana, some 40 miles away, a distant gleam of silver in the morning sun, its forested shore stretching away into the haze. The sooner we were under cover in those woods, the better. So we travelled at the Highlander's pace, a mile at the trot and a mile at the stride, followed by a moment's rest standing, and then away again. Ulliver ran like a Diana, and I like a labouring bullock, but not too bad for 45, and within the hour we were in sight of a village of the plain called Azez, which I supposed we should avoid. But Ulibar said the time for concealment was past now, that we were afoot, and besides, we'd get no news of Mastiat if we continued to skulk in rocks and bushes.
We must seek it out, in a safe place where there are safe people to question. No, not in the village.
We had stopped in a grove some way short of the little cluster of thatched huts, and she was shading her eyes to scan the low hills beyond.
There should be a monastery over yonder, of monks of St. Antonius the Hermit, if the wars have passed them by. Monks know everything.
And if they recognize you, they could pass word to this fellow Gobazi who's after you, or even to Theodore.
We've seen no trace of Gobazi. No one will recognize me this far south. And Theodore has no more bitter enemy than the church since he plundered and murdered at Metraha last summer. Anyway, we have no choice. So come, and keep your ears open for the monastery bell.
We set off across the plain, and as we went, skirting well wide of the village, she told me of Theodore's crowning infamy at Metraha, an island in Lake Tana which had been a holy place of sanctuary from time immemorial, and consequently a haven much used by merchants to deposit their treasures. St. Paul's crossed with the Bank of England, if you like. Theodore had gained access to it by treachery, looted its vast store of gold, silver, grains, and precious stuff, and then herded the inhabitants, priests, merchants, women, and children, into the principal buildings, and burned them to death.
So, we ran no risk of betrayal to Theodore. Rather, says Ulibar complacently, will the Holy Father show all kindness and respect to a noble lady of Tigre, bound for the court of the Queen of the Galas, who had the misfortune to be robbed of her caravan by Sudani bandits, who murdered her servants, and would assuredly have slain her, or worse, had she not escaped by night with her faithful Hindi attendant, hence her destitute condition.
Lucky for her, she was able to deck her destitution with a few choice trinkets. Oh, and a purse of dollars,
which she was fortunate to be able to carry away with her, and from which she will make a generous gift to the monastery's alms chest. If that does not move their pity, says she, I know nothing of Christian priests. Besides, these will be provincial simpletons, probably awe-stricken in the presence of rank.
I didn't doubt that, but one snag occurred to me. They're Coptic Christians, aren't they? Suppose they spot you for a gala. After all, you're on your way to Mastiat. Can you pass as a Christian? She gave me her superior smile and drew from the bosom of her tunic one of the necklaces she pinched from the Sudanese hoard, a fine cord of pale blue silk skilfully intertwined with gold and silver threads.
This is called matab. Is it not beautiful? All Christians of Habesh wear them from their baptism. It is the first thing those Christos look for in each other. And this one, as you see, is of the most precious kind, such as only the high-born and wealthy would wear.
Hey, but listen, the bell.
It was tolling faintly, but stopped as we entered the little valley in which stood a plain adobe building of no great size, walled with an arched gateway, and surrounded by plots too small to be called fields, in which white-robed abs were digging and hoeing without enthusiasm. They stopped to stare as the high-born Lady of Tigre, a striking figure in her scanty tunic, boots, and veiled fillet, sashayed towards the gate with her faithful Hindi attendant throwing a chest as he followed dutifully in her wake. Chanting greeted us as we passed through the archway into a courtyard where a crowd of robed and turbaned jossers were waking the echoes with what I learned later was a Coptic psalm, and plainly we were intruding on a service, or, as it proved, a rehearsal for one. Palm Sunday, no less, which fell a week hence. The turbaned lads were priests bearing strange long wands, with heads like crutches, while the commonalty and sundry infants carried palm fronds. To the fore was a dignified old file called the Abba, which I suppose is abbot. He wore a very stylish yellow leather coat and carried a curious article like a catapult with abacus beads between its arms, which he waved from time to time. In attendance were a priest bearing a fancy sort of decorated cross, a tiny chico with a bell as big as himself, and two deacons holding up an enormous Bible. Even as we appeared, the singing stopped, and the Abba began to read from the Bible, but left off in some confusion when one of the deacons drew his attention to Ulaba Walk, who was listening attentively, hand on hip, nodding approval. Everyone goggled at her, as well they might, for she was posed like the Queen of Sheba, waving a graceful hand to them to continue, and then turning aside to seat herself on a bench by the gateway. The Abba, who'd been taken flat aback, it dawned on me that there wasn't another female in the courtyard, steadied up and began reading again in a shaky falsetto, but shooting little disturbed glances in Ulaba's direction as she crossed her legs and sat back, finger on cheek, gently smiling, as though she were watching a show perform for her benefit. The reading finished, cut short, I suspect, the Abba and his gang retired through an inner doorway, shooting more little glances, and presently a bald chap with a staff of office approached Ulaba and invited her within. She rose with dignity, made a little gesture to me which I interpreted as an order to scatter a few dollars to the hoi polloi, and swanned away. I distributed, smirking, bowed tactfully to the cross-bearer who was leading the peasantry in another psalm, and hastened after my mistress like a good little minion. Even with my limited Amharic, I could follow much that was said at the audience which followed in the monastery chapel. Ulaba was conducted with great deference to a chair hurriedly placed between the front pews, while the Abba enthroned himself nervously on a stool before the altar, his attendants standing by with palms, crutches, and open mouths. I don't know if Coptic priests are celibate, but these gaped at her like hayseeds at a burlesque show in the Chicago Loop. I don't suppose their modest little god hutch had ever seen her like, and she played it like the grandest of dames, surveying them coolly and turning that elegant profile as she swept off her fillet and veil and handed them carelessly to me, looking stern beside her chair. She charmed them with a gracious apology for interrupting their rehearsal, and the Abba near fell off his stool, assuring her that it didn't matter tuppence, honestly, and please, how could they serve Her Excellency? This, before she'd said a word about being a great swell on her way to a queen's court, or being despoiled. She did it simply by style, and looks, and those remarkable legs, and had them eating out of her dainty palm. Awe-stricken, she said they'd be, and awe-struck they were. The account of our adventures which she gave them was succinct and fairly offhand, but it had them agog, knuckles to teeth and gasping concern. The Abba didn't know what Habesh was coming to, what with evil emperors and foreign invaders and plundering rebels and noble ladies molested and robbed by heathen brigands, God forgive them. But what protection and comfort the church could offer, she should have, and her servant too, infidel though he was. This consisted of food, drink, attention, prayers, the best chamber in the monastery, placed at her ladyship's disposal, with a mattress in the passage for Vilkins the butler, and the promise of such clothing, equipment, and transport as could be drummed up overnight.
End of CD 4. CD 5.
I was given my victuals in the monk's refectory, watched by curious and none too friendly eyes, for they've no use for non-Christians, and as a Hindi, I was right beyond the pale. Ulaba dined in some state in the Abba's private apartments, and if the news she got was confused and disturbing, it was definite at least on the main point.
Mastiat has her camp on the Abai River, below the falls which the people of Mecha call the Great Silver Smoke.
She was jubilant.
5 days' journey by horse or camel, even by the western shore of Tana, see?
The Abba had given her a map, a pretty coloured thing with Lake Tana all little blue waves with boats afloat and an ark at anchor with hippos and pythons and monkeys clambering aboard under the eye of a distinctly Ethiopian Noah, the whole lot being blessed by a dusky Jesus.
Here, Atha says, we are 40 miles from Gogora, at the head of the lake, another 50 at most to Zaga, and perhaps 50 down to Abai.
Why not the straight way by the east shore? I could see it would cut the journey by as much as a third.
Because Theodore has his camp at Korata last year.
She tapped a finger on it.
And he will have troops there still. And who knows how many between the lake and his army which marches on Magdala. He has wasted all Begenda, and these churchmen say he is already at the Jeddah Ravine. But their news will be a week old. He may be close on Magdala by now.
And Mastiat's army, by your reckoning, is about 90 miles from Magdala. Where's Napier? Do they know?
They heard of him last at Antalu, but that too will be old news. At best, he can hardly be more than a day's march south of the Ashangi Lake.
She traced her finger up from Magdala. Napier had a good 100 miles to go by the look of it. Well, Theodore can win the race on a tight rein, says I, if he gets his guns into Magdala. I didn't care to think of that. The place was said to be impregnable, which was doubtless an exaggeration. British troops can take anywhere, given a commander who knows his business. But the bug hunter didn't have time for a siege, not with his striking force at full stretch, with food and forage running low. If he came to a dead stop before Theodore's defences, well, it would be a dead stop indeed, far from home and no way back. His army would starve where it stood, and Theodore's Highlanders would cut up the remains at leisure. No doubt, with the rebel warlords joining in. My consolation was that I'd be better placed as a free agent with Ulaba rather than as a helpless lump of cannon fodder in Napier's last stand. I had a sudden, horrid recollection of Gandamak, with the 44th trapped on the icy slope, Sutar with the colours round his middle, and the Ghazis closing in. I asked about the rebels, and she spat,
"Cattle! Cowards! They ran in circles, frightened of Theodore, fearful of each other. That much is plain from this old fool of an abba's tale, but he knows little more to any purpose. That drunken fat sow Mastiat," sneers she with satisfaction, "had the game won. Had she used the wit she wastes in guzzling and coupling. 2 months ago she stood before Magdala with her army, while its garrison of weaklings and traitors wrung their hands, willing to surrender, but in dread of Theodore's vengeance when he returned from plundering in Begenda. Oh, had I stood in her place, they'd have surrendered fast enough."
She clenched her fists and shook them, and I believed her.
"But she puts off and idles away her opportunity, and is forced to retreat at last because the hyena Gobazi and the jackal Menelek come prowling into Gala country, afraid to attack Magdala, but still outnumbering her, so she withdraws to the Abai. It is very well," says she, pleased as punch. "Things could not stand better."
Blessed if I could see that, and I said so. If she has cut and run, what's the use in our going on? She and her army will be no help to Napier if they're 90 miles away. She waved that aside.
"Gala armies can move at speed. Besides, she'll have left more warriors in the hills about Magdala, ready for action, than she'll have taken to the Abai. Let the Queen of Wolo-Gala but say the word, and there will be a steel ring. Was not that what your general called it? Round the amber of Magdala, with Theodore held fast within."
The Queen of Wolo-Gala. But which queen? We had been discussing her ambitions and what part I might be called on to play in realizing them when the Sudanis had interrupted us and the topic had not been resumed. Well, it could be let lie for the moment. That she'd make a bid for her sister's throne I knew, if not when, where, or how. In the meantime, it was enough that we knew Mastiat's whereabouts and that these jovial monks would speed us on our way. They didn't stint us either with the loan of 2 camels, their saddlebags filled with grub and flasks of tej, cloaks and blankets, and a couple of chicos to race ahead to make sure our coast was clear. Ulaba made no offer of payment, simply fluttering a queenly hand at me, and I presented the chief deacon with a purse of $50, to which she added one of her bracelets, which she presented in fine, Lady Bountiful style to a small girl in the crowd, For every soul in the place, priests, lay brethren, labourers and menials, was on hand to see us off. We mounted the camels. They lurched to their feet. The Abba blessed us, and off we went, with a camel groom trotting in our wake. He would bring the beast back from Lake Tana, where we would seek other transport. A chorus of farewells followed us, and before we were out of earshot, they were making a joyful noise to the Lord, either in rehearsal for Palm Sunday or rejoicing for the dollars. I'm no old Africa hand, and what I'd seen of Abyssinia so far had jaundiced rather than impressed, but I'm bound to say that the Lake Tana country is as close to earthly paradise as I've ever struck, for scenery at least. From Azez to Gorgora on the northern shore is nothing out of the ordinary, but the lake itself beats anything in Switzerland or Italy. A great blue shimmering inland sea, fringed by tropical forest, hills and meadows. For all the world like a glorious garden of exotic flowers and shrubs in groves of splendid trees and ferns. The woods are alive with birds of every colour and size, from tiny feathered mites hardly bigger than butterflies to the mighty hornbill, a black and white monster as big as a man, braying as it rushes overhead like some flying dragon. There's an abundance of game, deer and antelopes and monkeys everywhere, buffalo ranging on the slopes, huge hippos surging and bellowing in the lake itself, and the biggest snakes in Africa, 20-foot pythons in shining coats of many colours, gliding through the shallows. Good camels can cover the ground as quickly as horses, and we made our first night camp in a little palm grove only a few miles from the lake. Uluba said it would be safer to steer clear of Gorgora, so next morning we made a beeline for the western shore and the cover of the jungly forest. It had not been determined precisely where on Tana the groom should turn back with the camels, and when Uluba said we'd like to take them as far as the Abai source, he had severe conniptions. He was one of your tough, lean abs who run like stags, and had kept up easily with his long, loping stride. But he was shot if he was going to venture any nearer the dreaded Negus Tuwudros than he had to. Everyone knew of the carnage that had been wreaked south of the lake, of the burning and blinding and hacking off of ears and noses. Why, all Mecha was a smoking desert. Uluba came the headmistress with him, but he wasn't to be moved. And it was only when she'd offered him $20 and he'd beaten her up to 30 that he reluctantly agreed to come as far as Edina, near the foot of the lake.
"We could have killed him and kept the camels," says Uluba, as we rode on our way with the groom trotting moodily after. "But he might have fought. And what is $30?
I wondered if she'd have expected me to do the dirty deed. Knowing her style, probably not. It took us the best part of the day to reach Edina, a little fishing village in a pretty clearing by the shore. They were almost the first folk we'd seen since leaving Azez, friendly enough peasants, but, like our groom, apprehensive of what lay further south, and thankful that Theodore's campaign of terror had not touched them so far. Zage and Bahidare had been razed to the ground, and all the people killed or driven away. Yes, Theodore's soldiers were still at Kurata across the lake, but no, nothing would induce them to ferry us anywhere near the city, or indeed even down the coast. Having seen their boats, crazy coracles of woven bulrushes that were permanently waterlogged, I was happy to continue our journey on foot. To Uluba's fury, our groom, gossiping at the evening meal which we shared with the village headman, mentioned that we were on our way to find Queen Mastiat. It seemed harmless to me, but she was spitting blood later when she explained that the nearer we got to our goal, the greater our danger, with Theodore's lances on hand.
"I knew we should have slit the chattering bastard's throat. Well, he has our dollars, but we'll not bid him goodbye. When all are asleep, do you take the saddlebags from the camels, and we'll be away before dawn."
It seemed to me she was starting at shadows. These folk hate